own picture to hang on the wall. It's the first thing I'll do, she thought as her fingers closed over the bundle of tissue. The very first. She unwrapped the ring and held it out to Steiner, but he ignored it for the time being. He was studying the picture. It's an original oil, not a print, he said. And I don't think it's very good. Probably that's why it's covered with glass, somebody's idea of dolling it up. What's that building at the bottom of the hill supposed to be? Burned-out plantation house? I believe it's supposed to be the ruins of a temple, the old guy with the mangy briefcase said quietly. A Greek temple, perhaps. Oh, it's difficult to say, isn't it? It was difficult to say, because the building in question was buried almost to the roof in underbrush. Vines were growing up the five columns in front, a sixth lay in segments. Near the fallen pillar was a fallen statue, so overgrown that all that could be glimpsed above the green was a smooth white stone face looking up at the thunderheads with which the painter had enthusiastically filled the sky. Yeah, Steiner said. Anyway, it looks to me like the building's out of perspective. It's too big for where it is. The old man nodded. But it's a necessary cheat. Otherwise nothing would show but the roof. As for the fallen pillar and statue, forget them. They wouldn't be visible at all. She didn't care about the background. All of her attention was fixed upon the painting's central figure. At the top of the hill, turned to look down at the ruins of the temple so anyone viewing the picture could only see her back, was a woman. Her hair was blonde and hung down her back in a plait. Around one of her shapely upper arms, the right, was a broad circle of gold. Her left hand was raised, and although you couldn't see for sure, it looked as if she was shading her eyes. It was odd, given the thundery, sunless sky, but that was what she appeared to be doing just the same. She was wearing a short dress, a toga, Rosie supposed, which left one creamy shoulder bare. The garment's color was a vibrant red-purple. It was impossible to tell what, if anything, she was wearing on her feet. The grass that she was standing in came almost up to her knees where the toga ended. What do you call it? Steiner asked. He was speaking to Robbie. Classical? Neoclassical? I call it bad art, Robbie said with a grin. But at the same time, I think I understand why this woman wants it. It has an emotional quality to it that's quite striking. The elements may be classical, the sort of thing one might see in old steel engravings, but the feel is Gothic. And then there's the fact that the principal figure has her back turned. I find that very odd. On the whole, well, one can't say this young lady has chosen the best picture in the joint, but I'm sure she's chosen the most peculiar one. Rosie was still barely hearing them. She kept finding new things in the picture to engage her attention. The dark violet cord around the woman's waist, for instance, which matched her robe's trim and the barest hint of a left breast revealed by the raised arm. The two men were only nattering. It was a wonderful picture. She felt she could look at it for hours on end, and when she had her new place, she would probably do just that. No title, no signature, Steiner said, unless he turned the picture around. Printed in soft, slightly blurred charcoal strokes on the paper backing were the words, Rose Madder. Well, he said doubtfully, here's the artist's name, I guess. Funny name, though. Maybe it's a pseudonym. Robbie shook his head, opened his mouth to speak, then saw that the woman who had chosen the picture also knew better. It's the name of the picture, she said, and then she added for some reason she could never have explained, Rose is my name. Steiner looked at her, completely bewildered. Never mind, that's just a coincidence. But was it, she wondered? Was it really? Look. She gently turned the picture around again. She tapped the glass over the toga the woman in the foreground was wearing. That color, that purply red, is called Rose Madder. She's right, Robbie said. Either the artist, or more likely the last person to own the picture, since charcoal rubs away fairly rapidly, has named the painting after the color of the woman's chiton. Please, Rose said to Steiner. Could we do our business? I'm anxious to be on my way. I'm late, as it is. Steiner started to ask once more if she was sure, but he saw that she was. He saw something else as well. She had a fine-drawn look about her, one that suggested she'd had a difficult go of it just lately. It was the face of a woman who might regard honest interest and concern as teasing, or possibly as an effort to alter the terms of the deal in his own favor. He simply nodded. The ring for the picture, straight trade, and we both go away happy. Yes, Rosie said, and gave him a smile of dazzling brilliance. It was the first real smile she had given anyone in 14 years, and in the moment of its fullness his heart opened to her. And we both go away happy. She stood outside for a moment, blinking stupidly at the cars rushing past, feeling the way she had as a small child after leaving the movies with her father, dazed, caught with half of her brain in the world of real things, and half of it still in the world of make-believe. But the picture was real enough. She only had to look down at the parcel she held under her left arm if she doubted that. The door opened behind her, and the elderly man came out. Now she even felt good about him, and she gave him the sort of smile people reserve for those with whom they have shared strange or marvelous experiences. Madam, he said, would you consider doing me a small favor? Her smile was replaced with a look of caution. It depends on what it is, but I'm not in the habit of doing favors for strangers. That, of course, was an understatement. She wasn't even used to talking to strangers. He looked almost embarrassed, and this had a reassuring effect on her. Yes, well, I suppose it'll sound odd, but it might benefit both of us. My name is Lefferts, by the way, Rob Lefferts.
Rosie McClendon, she said.
She thought about holding out her hand and rejected the idea. Probably she shouldn't even have given him her name.
I really don't think I have time to do any favors, Mr. Lefferts. I'm running a little late, and
please. He put down his weary briefcase, reached into the small brown bag he was holding in his other hand, and brought out one of the old paperbacks he'd found inside the pawn shop. On the cover was a stylized picture of a man in a black-and-white striped prison outfit, stepping into what might have been a cave or the mouth of a tunnel. All I want is for you to read the first paragraph of this book out loud.
Here, she looked around, right here on the street. In heaven's name, why?
He only repeated, please. And she took the book, thinking that if she did as he asked, she might be able to get away from him without any further foolishness. That would be fine, because she was starting to think he was a little nuts. Maybe not dangerous, but nuts all the same. And if he did turn out to be dangerous, she wanted to find out while the Liberty City Loan and Pawn and Bill Steiner was still within dashing distance. The name of the book was Dark Passage, the author David Goodis. As she paged past the copyright notice, Rosie decided it wasn't surprising she'd never heard of him, although the title of the novel rang a faint bell. Dark Passage had been published in 1946, 16 years before she was born. She looked up at Rob Lefferts. He nodded eagerly at her, almost vibrating with anticipation. And hope? How could that be? But it certainly looked like hope. Feeling a little excited herself now, like calls to like, her mother had often said, Rosie began to read. The first paragraph was short, at least. It was a tough break. Parry was innocent. On top of that, he was a decent sort of guy who never bothered people and wanted to lead a quiet life. But there was too much on the other side, and on his side of it there was practically nothing. The jury decided he was guilty. The judge handed him a life sentence, and he was taken to San Quentin. She looked up, closed the book, held it out to him. Okay? He was smiling, clearly delighted. Very much okay, Miss McClendon. Now, wait, just one more. Humor me. He went paging rapidly through the book, then handed it back to her. Just the dialogue, please. The scene is between Parry and a cab driver from Well, it's funny. Do you see it? She saw, and this time she didn't demur. She had decided Lefferts wasn't dangerous, and that maybe he wasn't crazy either. Also, she still felt that queer sense of excitement, as if something really interesting was going to happen, or was happening already. Yes, sure, you bet, the voice inside told her happily. The picture, Rosie, remember? Sure, of course, the picture. Just thinking of it lifted her heart and made her feel lucky. This is very peculiar, she said, but she was smiling. She couldn't help herself. He nodded, and she had an idea that he would have nodded in exactly the same way if she'd told him her name was Madame Bovary. Yes, yes, I'm sure it seems that way, but do you see where I want you to start?
Uh-huh.
She scanned the dialogue quickly, trying to get a sense of who these people were from what they were saying. The cab driver was easy. She quickly formed a mental picture of Jackie Gleason as Ralph Cramden in the Honeymooners reruns they showed on Channel 18 in the afternoons. Perry was a little harder. Generic hero, she supposed, comes in a white can. Oh, well, it's no big deal either way. She cleared her throat and began, quickly forgetting that she was standing on a busy street corner with a wrapped painting under her arm, unaware of the curious glances she and Lefferts were drawing. "Well, it's funny," the driver said. "From faces I can tell what people think. I can tell what they do. Sometimes I can even tell who they are. You, for instance. All right, me, what about me? You're a guy with troubles." "I don't have a trouble in the world," Perry said. "Don't tell me, brother," the driver said. I know people. I'll tell you something else. Your trouble is women. Strike one, I'm happily married." Suddenly, just like that, she had a voice for Perry. He was James Woods, nervous and high-strung, but with a brittle sense of humor. This delighted her, and she went on, warming to the story now, seeing a scene from a movie that had never been made inside her head. Jackie Gleason and James Woods sparring in a cab that was racing through the streets of some anonymous city after dark. "Call it a two-base hit. You're not married, but you used to be, and it wasn't happy. Oh, I get it. You were there. You were hiding in the closet all the time." The driver said, "I'll tell you about her. She wasn't easy to get along with. She wanted things. The more she got, the more she wanted. And she always got what she wanted. That's the picture." Rosie had reached the bottom of the page. Feeling a strange chill up her back, she silently handed the book back to Lefferts, who now looked happy enough to hug himself. "Your voice is absolutely wonderful," he told her. "Low, but not drony, melodious and very clear, with no definable accent. I knew all that at once, but voice alone means very little. You can read, though. You can actually read." "Of course I can read," Rosie said. She didn't know whether to be amused or exasperated. "Do I look like I was raised by wolves?" "No, of course not. But often even very good readers aren't able to read aloud. Even if they don't actually stumble over the words, they have very little in the way of expression. And dialogue is much tougher than narration. The acid test, one might say. But I heard two different people. I actually heard them."
"Yes, so did I. Mr. Lefferts, I really have to go now.
He reached out and touched her lightly on the shoulder as she started to turn away. A woman with a bit more experience of the world would have known an audition, even one on a street corner, for what it was, and consequently would not have been entirely surprised by what Lefferts said next. Rosie, however, was stunned to temporary silence when he cleared his throat and offered her a job.
At the moment Rob Lefferts was listening to his fugitive wife read on a street corner, Norman Daniels was sitting in his small office cubicle on the fourth floor of police headquarters with his feet up on his desk and his hands laced behind his head. It was the first time in years that it had been possible for him to put his feet up. Under ordinary circumstances, his desk was heaped high with forms, fast food wrappers, half-written reports, departmental circulars, memos, and other assorted trash. Norman was not the sort of man who picks up after himself without thinking about it. In just 5 weeks, the house which Rose kept pinned neat across all the years had come to look quite a bit like Miami after Hurricane Andrew. And usually, his office reflected this, but now it looked positively austere. He had spent most of the day cleaning it out, taking 3 large plastic garbage bags full of swill down to the waste disposal site in the basement, not wanting to leave the job to the nigger woman who came in to clean between midnight and 6 on weekday mornings. What was left to niggers didn't get done. This was a lesson Norman's father had taught him, and it was a true lesson. That was one basic fact which the politicians and the do-gooders either could not or would not understand. Niggers didn't understand work. It was their African temperament. Norman ran his gaze slowly across the top of his desk, upon which nothing now rested but his feet and his phone, then shifted his eyes to the wall on his right. For years, this had been papered with want sheets, hot sheets, lab results, and takeout menus, not to mention his calendar with pending court dates noted in red. But now it was completely bare. He finished his visual tour by noting the stack of cardboard liquor cartons by the door. As he did so, he reflected how unpredictable life was. He had a temper, and he would have been the first to admit it. That his temper had a way of getting him in trouble and keeping him in trouble was also something he would have freely admitted. And if, a year ago, he had been granted a vision of his office as it was today, he would have drawn a simple conclusion from it. His temper had finally gotten him into a jam he couldn't wiggle out of, and he had been canned. Either he had finally piled up enough reprimands in his jacket to warrant dismissal under departmental rules, or he had been caught really hurting someone, as he supposed he had really hurt the little spick, Ramon Sanders. The idea that it mattered if a queer boy like Ramon got hurt a little was ridiculous, of course. St. Anthony he was not, but you had to abide by the rules of the game, or at least not be caught breaking them. It was like not saying out loud that niggers didn't understand the concept of work, although everybody white at least, knew it. But he was not being canned. He was moving, that was all. Moving from this shitty little cubicle, which had been home since the first year of the Bush presidency, moving into a real office where the walls went all the way up to the ceiling and came all the way down to the floor. Not canned, promoted. It made him think of a Chuck Berry song, the one that went, "C'est la vie, it goes to show you never can tell." The bust had happened, the big one, and things couldn't have gone better for him if he had written the script himself. An almost unbelievable transmutation had taken place. His ass had turned to gold, at least around here. It had been a citywide crack ring, the sort of combine you never get whole and complete. Except this time he had. Everything had fallen into place. It had been like rolling a dozen straight sevens at a crap table in Atlantic City and doubling your money every time. His team had ended up arresting over 20 people, half a dozen of them really big bugs, and the busts were righteous, not so much as a whiff of entrapment. The DA was probably reaching heights of orgasm unmatched since cornholing his cocker spaniel back in junior high school. Norman, who had once believed he might end up being prosecuted by that geeky little fuck if he couldn't manage to put a check rein on his temper, had become the DA's fair-haired boy. Chuck Berry had been right. You never could tell. The coolerator was jammed with TV dinners and ginger ale, Norman sang and smiled. It was a cheerful smile, one that made most people want to smile back at him, but it would have chilled Rose's skin and made her frantically wish to be invisible. She thought of it as Norman's biting smile. A very good spring on top, a very good spring indeed, but underneath it had been a very bad spring, a totally shitty spring to be exact, and Rose was the reason why. He had expected to settle her hash long before now, but he hadn't. Somehow, Rose was still out there somewhere. He had gone to Portside on the very same day he had interrogated his good friend Ramon in the park across from the station. He had gone with a picture of Rose, but it hadn't been much help. When he mentioned the sunglasses and the bright red scarf, valuable details he had found in the transcript of Ramon Sanders's original interrogation, one of Continental's 2 daytime ticket sellers had hollered bingo. The only problem was that the ticket seller couldn't remember what her destination had been, and there was no way to check the records because there were no records. She had paid cash for her ticket and checked no baggage. Continental's schedule had offered three possibilities, but Norman thought the third, a bus which had departed on the southern route at 1:45 p.m., was unlikely. She wouldn't have wanted to hang around that long. That left two other choices, a city 250 miles away and another, larger city in the heart of the Midwest. He had then made what he was slowly coming to believe had been a mistake, one which had cost him at least 2 weeks. He had assumed that she wouldn't want to go too far from home, from the area where she'd grown up, not a scared little mouse like her. But now... Norman's palms were covered with a faint lacework of semicircular white scars. They had been made by his fingernails, but their real source was deep inside his head, an oven which had been running at broil for most of his life. "You better be scared," he murmured, "and if you're not now, I guarantee you will be soon." Yes. He had to have her. Without Rose, everything that had happened this spring, the glamour bust, the good press, the reporters who stunned him by asking respectful questions for a change, even the promotion, meant nothing. The women he had slept with since Rose had left meant nothing either. What mattered was she had left him. What mattered more was he hadn't had the slightest clue she meant to do it. And what mattered most was she had taken his bank card. She'd only used it once, and for a paltry $350, but that wasn't the point. The point was, she had taken what was his. She had forgotten who was the meanest motherfucker in the jungle, and for that, she would have to pay. The price would be high, too. High. He'd strangled one of the women he'd been with since Rose left. Choked her, then dumped her behind a grain storage tower on the west side of the lake. Was he supposed to blame that one on his temper, too? He didn't know. How was that for nuts? For right out to lunch. All he knew was that he had picked the woman out of the strolling meat market down on Fremont Street, a little brunette honey, in fawn-colored hot pants with these big Daisy May tits poking out the front of her halter. He didn't really see how much she looked like Rose, or so he told himself now, and so he perhaps really believed, until he was shagging her in the back of his current duty car, an anonymous 4-year-old Chevy. What had happened was she turned her head, and the lights around the top of the nearest grain storage tower had shone on her face for a moment, shone on it in a certain way, and in that moment the whore was Rose, the bitch who had walked out on him without even leaving a note, without leaving so much as one fucking word, and before he knew what he was doing, he had the halter wrapped around the whore's neck, and the whore's tongue was sticking out of her mouth, and the whore's eyes were bulging out of their sockets like glass marbles. And the worst thing about it was that once she was dead, the whore hadn't looked like Rose at all. Well, he hadn't panicked, but then, why would he? It hadn't been the first time, after all. Had Rose known that? Sensed that? Was that why she had run? Because she was afraid he might? "Don't be an asshole," he muttered and closed his eyes. A bad idea. What he saw was what he all too often saw in his dreams lately. The green ATM card from Merchants Bank, grown to an enormous size and floating in the blackness like a currency-colored dirigible. He opened his eyes again in a hurry. His hands hurt. He unrolled his fingers and observed the welling cuts in his palms with no surprise. He was accustomed to the stigmata of his temper, and he knew how to deal with it, by reestablishing control. That meant thinking and planning, and those things began with review. He had called the police in the closer of the two cities, had identified himself, and then had identified Rose as the prime suspect in a big-money bank card scam. The card was the worst thing of all, and it never really left his mind anymore. He gave her name as Rose McClendon, feeling sure she would have gone back to her maiden name. If it turned out she hadn't, he would simply pass off as a coincidence the fact that the suspect and the investigating officer shared the same name. It had been known to happen, and it was Daniels they were talking about, not Trzuski or Boschatz. He had also faxed the cops side-by-side pictures of Rose. One was a photo of her sitting on the back steps taken by Roy Foster, a cop friend of his, last August. It wasn't very good. It showed how much lard she'd put on since hitting the big 3-0, for one thing. But it was black and white and showed her facial features with reasonable clarity. The other was a police artist's conception. Al Kelly, one talented son of a bitch, had done it on his own time at Norman's request, of the same woman, only with a scarf over her head. The cops in that other city, the closer city, had asked all the right questions and had gone to all the right places, the homeless shelters, the transient hotels, the halfway houses where you could sometimes get a look at the current guest list if you knew who and how to ask, with no result. Norman himself had made as many calls as he'd had time for, hunting with ever-increasing frustration for some sort of paper trail. He even paid for a faxed list of the city's newest driver's license applicants with no result. The idea that she might escape him entirely, escape her just punishment for what she had done, especially for daring to take the bank card, still hadn't crossed his mind, but he now reluctantly came to the conclusion that she could have gone to that other city after all, that she could have been so afraid of him that 250 miles just wasn't far enough. Not that 800 miles would be, a fact that she would soon learn. In the meantime, he had been sitting here long enough. It was time to find a dolly or a janitor's car and start moving his crap into his new office 2 floors up. He swung his feet off the desk, and as he did, the telephone rang. He picked it up. "Is this Inspector Daniels?" the voice on the other end asked. "Yes, it is," he replied, thinking, with no great pleasure, "Detective Inspector First Grade Daniels, as a matter of fact. Oliver Robbins here." Robbins. Robbins. The name was familiar, but from Continental Express? I sold a bus ticket to a woman you're looking for? Daniel sat up straighter in his seat. "Yes, Mr. Robbins. I remember you very well." "I saw you on television," Robbins said. "It's wonderful that you caught those people. That crack is awful stuff. We see people using it in the bus station all the time, you know." "Yes," Daniel said, allowing no trace of impatience to show in his voice. "I'm sure you do. Will those people actually go to jail?" "I think most of them will. How can I help you today?" "Actually, I'm hoping that I can help you," Robbins said. "Do you remember telling me to call you if I remembered anything else? About the woman in the dark glasses and red scarf, I mean." "Yes," Norman said. His voice was still calm and friendly, but the hand not holding the phone had rolled into a tight fist again, and the nails were digging, digging. "Well, I didn't think I would, but something came to me this morning while I was in the shower. I've been thinking about it all day, and I'm sure I'm right. She really did say it that way." "Say what? What way?" he asked. His voice was still reasonable, calm, pleasant even, but now blood was brightly visible in the creases of his closed fist. Norman opened one of the drawers of his empty desk and hung the fist over it, a little baptism on behalf of the next man to use this shitty little closet. "You see, she didn't tell me where she wanted to go. I told her. That's probably why I couldn't remember when you asked me, Inspector Daniels, although my head for that sort of thing is usually quite good." "I'm not getting you. People buying tickets usually give you their destination," Robbins said. "Give me a round trip to Nashville, or one way to Lansing, please. Follow me?" "Yes." "This woman didn't do it that way. She didn't say the name of the place. She said the time she wanted to go. That's what I remembered this morning in the shower. She said, 'I want to buy a ticket on the 1105 bus. Are there still some seats on that one?' As if the place she was going didn't matter. As if it only mattered that she go as quick as she could and get as far away as she could," Norman exclaimed. "Yes, yes, of course. Thanks, Mr. Robbins. I'm glad I could help." Robbins sounded a bit taken aback by the burst of emotion from the other end of the line. "This woman, you guys must really want her." "We do," Norman said. He was once more smiling the smile which had always chilled Rosie's skin and made her want to back up against a wall to protect her kidneys. "You bet we do. That 1105 bus, Mr. Robbins, where does it go?" Robbins told him, then asked, "Was she part of the crack ring? The woman you're looking for?" "No, it's a credit card scam," Norman said, and Robbins started to reply to that. He was apparently ready to settle into a comfy little chat, but Norman dropped the phone back into the cradle, cutting him off in mid-rap. He put his feet up on the desk again. Finding a dolly and moving his crap could wait. He leaned back in the desk chair and looked at the ceiling. "A credit card scam, you bet," he said. "But you know what they say about the long arm of the law." He reached out with his left hand and opened his fist, exposing the blood-smeared palm. He flexed the fingers, which were also bloody. Long arm of the law, bitch, he said, and suddenly began to laugh. Long fucking arm of the law. Coming for you. You best believe it. He kept flexing his fingers, watching small drops of blood patter down to the surface of his desk, not caring, laughing, feeling fine. Things were back on track again.
When she got back to DNS, Rosie found Pam sitting in a folding chair in the basement rec room. She had a paperback in her lap, but she was watching Gert Kinshaw and a skinny little thing who had come in about 10 days before, Cynthia something. Cynthia had a gaudy punk hairdo, half green, half orange, and looked as if she might weigh all of 90 pounds. There was a bulky bandage over her left ear, which her boyfriend had tried, with a fair amount of success, to tear off. She was wearing a tank top with Peter Tosh at the center of a swirling, blue-green, psychedelic sunburst. Not gonna give it up, the shirt proclaimed. Every time she moved, the oversized armholes of the shirt disclosed her teacup-sized breasts and small, strawberry-colored nipples. She was panting, and her face streamed with sweat, but she looked almost daffily pleased to be where she was and who she was. Gert Kinshaw was as different from Cynthia as dark from day. Rosie had never gotten it completely clear in her mind if Gert was a counselor, a longtime resident of DNS, or just a friend of the court, so to speak. She showed up, stayed a few days, and then disappeared again. She often sat in the circle during therapy sessions. These ran twice a day at DNS, with attendance at 4 a week, a mandatory condition for residents. But Rosie had never heard her say anything. She was tall, 6'1" at least, and big. Her shoulders were wide and soft and dark brown, her breasts the size of melons, and her belly a large pendulous pod that pooched out her size extra, extra, extra large T-shirts and hung over the sweatpants she always wore. Her hair was a jumble of frizzy braids. It was very kinky. She looked so much like one of those women you saw sitting in the laundromat, eating Twinkies and reading the latest issue of the National Enquirer, that it was easy to miss the hard flex of her biceps, the toned look of her thighs under the old gray sweatpants, and the way her big ass did not jiggle when she walked. The only time Rosie ever heard her talk much was during these rec room seminars. Gert taught the fine art of self-defense to any and all DNS residents who wanted to learn. Rosie had taken a few lessons herself and still tried to practice what Gert called 6 great ways to fuck up an asshole at least once a day. She wasn't very good at them and couldn't imagine actually trying them on a real man, the guy with the David Crosby mustache leaning in the doorway of the Wee Nip, for instance. But she liked Gert. She particularly liked the way Gert's broad, dark face changed when she was teaching, breaking out of its customary clay-like immobility and taking on animation and intelligence, becoming pretty, in fact. Rosie had once asked her what exactly she was teaching. Was it taekwondo or jujitsu or karate? Some other discipline, perhaps. Gert had just shrugged. "Little of this and a little of that," she had said. "Leftovers." Now the ping-pong table had been moved aside and the middle of the rec room floor had been covered with gray mats. 8 or 9 folding chairs had been set up along one pine-paneled wall between the ancient stereo and the prehistoric color TV, where everything looked either pale green or pale pink. The only chair currently occupied was the one Pam was sitting on. With her book in her lap, her hair tied back with a piece of blue yarn, and her knees primly together, she looked like a wallflower at a high school dance. Rosie sat down next to her, propping her rapt picture against her shins. Gert, easily 270 pounds, and Cynthia, who probably could have tipped the scales over 100 only by wearing Georgia Giants and a fully loaded backpack, circled each other. Cynthia was panting and smiling hugely. Gert was calm and silent, slightly bent at her non-waist, her arms held out in front of her. Rosie looked at them, both amused and uneasy. It was like watching a squirrel, or maybe a chipmunk, stalk a bear.
"I was getting worried about you," Pam said. "The thought of a search party had crossed my mind, actually."
"I had the most amazing afternoon. How about you, though? How you feeling?"
"Better. In my opinion, my doll is the answer to all the world's problems. Never mind that. What happened to you? You're glowing."
"Really?"
"Really. So give. How come?"
"Well, let's see," Rosie said.
She began to tick things off on her fingers.
"I found out my engagement ring was a fake. I swapped it for a picture. I'm going to hang it in my new place when I get it. I got offered a job."
She paused, a calculating pause, and then added, "And I met someone interesting." Pam looked at her with round eyes.
"You're making it up."
"Nope, swear to God. Don't get your water hot, though. He's 65 if he's a day." She was speaking of Robbie Lefferts, but the image her mind briefly presented to her was Bill Steiner, he of the blue silk vest and interesting eyes. But that was ridiculous. At this point in her life, she needed love interest like she needed lip cancer. And besides, hadn't she decided that Steiner had to be at least 7 years younger than she? Just a baby, really.
"He's the one who offered me the job. His name is Robbie Lefferts, but never mind him right now. Want to see my new picture?"
"Ah, come on and do it," Gert said from the middle of the room. She sounded both amiable and irritated. "This ain't the school dance, sugar." The last word came out, sugar. Cynthia rushed her, the tail of her oversized tank top flapping. Gert turned sideways, took the slender girl with the two-tone hair by the forearms, and flipped her. Cynthia went over with her heels in the air and landed on her back. "Whee!" she said, and bounced back to her feet like a rubber ball.
"No, I don't want to see your picture," Pam said. "Not unless it's of the guy."
"Is he really 65? "I doubt it."
"Maybe older," Rosie said. "There was another one, though. He was the one who told me that the diamond in my engagement ring was only a zirconia. Then he traded me for the picture."
She paused.
"He wasn't 65.
"What did he look like?"
"Hazel eyes," Rosie said and bent over her picture. "No more until you tell me what you think of this."
"Rosie, don't be a booger."
Rosie grinned. She had almost forgotten the pleasures of a little harmless teasing, and continued to strip off the wrapping paper with which Bill Steiner had carefully covered the first meaningful purchase of her new life.
"Okay," Gert told Cynthia, who was once more circling her. Gert bounced slowly up and down on her large brown feet. Her breasts rose and subsided like ocean waves beneath the white T-shirt she was wearing. "You see how it's done. Now do it. Remember, you can't flip me, pipsqueak like you'd wind up in traction trying to flip a truck like me. But you can help me to flip myself. You ready?"
"Ready, ready, Teddy," Cynthia said. Her grin widened, revealing tiny, wicked white teeth. To Rosie, they looked like the teeth of some small but dangerous animal, a mongoose, perhaps.
"Gertrude Kinshaw, come on down." Gert rushed. Cynthia seized her meaty forearms, turned a flat, boyish hip into the swell of Gert's flank with a confidence Rosie knew she herself would never be able to match. And suddenly, Gert was airborne, flipping over in midair, a hallucination in a white shirt and gray sweatpants. The shirt slid up to reveal the largest bra Rosie had ever seen. The beige lycra cuffs looked like World War I artillery shells. When Gert hit the mats, the room shuddered.
"Yes!"
Cynthia screamed, dancing nimbly around and shaking her clasped hands over her head. "Big fucking mama goes down! Yes! Yes! Down for the count! Down for the fucking Smiling, a rare expression that turned her face into something rather gruesome, Gert picked Cynthia up, held her over her head for a moment with her tree-like legs spread, and then began to spin her like an airplane propeller.
"Oh, I'm gonna puke!"
Cynthia screamed, but she was laughing, too. She went around in a speedy blur of green-orange hair and psychedelic tank top.
"Oh, I'm gonna eject!"
"Gert, that's enough,"
a voice said quietly. It was Anna Stevenson, standing at the foot of the stairs. She was once again dressed in black and white. Rosie had seen her in other combinations, but not many. This time, tapered black pants and a white silk blouse with long sleeves and a high neck. Rosie envied her elegance. She always envied Anna's elegance. Looking slightly ashamed of herself, Gert set Cynthia gently back on her feet. "I'm okay, Anna," Cynthia said. She wobbled 4 zigzag steps across the mat, stumbled, sat down, and began to giggle. "I see you are," Anna said dryly.
"I flipped Gert," she said. "You should have seen it. I think it was the thrill of my life, honestly."
"I'm sure it was, but Gert would tell you she flipped herself," Anna said. "You just helped her do what her body wanted to do already."
"Yeah, I guess so," Cynthia said.
She got cautiously to her feet, then promptly plumped back down on her fanny, what there was of it, and giggled some more.
"God, it's like someone put the whole room on a record player."
And then, a little fearfully, she added, "What do you think?"
"I don't know. Let's get it into the light."
Anna picked the picture up by the sides of the frame, carried it across the room, and set it on the ping-pong table. The 5 women gathered around it in a semicircle. No, Rosie saw, glancing around, now they were 7. Robin St. James and Consuelo Delgado had come downstairs and joined them. They were standing behind Cynthia, looking over her narrow, bird-boned shoulders. Rosie waited for someone to break the silence. She was betting on Cynthia. And when nobody did, and it began to spin out, she started feeling nervous.
"Well," she asked at last, "what do you think? Somebody say something."
"It's an odd picture," Anna said.
"Yeah," Cynthia agreed. "Weird. I think I've seen one like it before, though."
Anna was looking at Rosie.
"Why did you buy it, Rosie?"
Rosie shrugged, feeling more nervous than ever. "I don't know that I can explain, really. It was like it called to me."
Anna surprised her and eased her considerably by smiling and nodding. "Yes, that's really all art is about, I think, and not just pictures. It's the same with books and stories and sculpture and even castles in the sand. Some things call to us, that's all. It's as if the people who made them were speaking inside our heads. But this particular painting, is it beautiful to you, Rosie?"
Rosie looked at it, trying to see it as she had in the Liberty City Loan and Pawn, when its silent tongue had spoken to her with such force that she had been stopped cold, all other thoughts driven from her mind. She looked at the blonde woman in the rose madder toga, or chiton, that was what Mr. Lefferts had called it, standing on the high grass at the top of the hill, again noting the plait which hung straight down the middle of her back and the gold armlet above her right elbow. Then she let her gaze move to the ruined temple and the tumbled god statue at the foot of the hill, the things the woman in the toga was looking at.
"How do you know that's what she's looking at? How can you know? You can't see her face."
That was true, of course. But what else was there to look at?
"No," Rosie said, "I didn't buy it because it was beautiful to me. I bought it because it seemed powerful to me. The way it stopped me in my tracks was powerful."
"Does a picture have to be beautiful to be good, do you think?"
"Nope," Consuela said. "Think about Jackson Pollock. His stuff wasn't about beauty, it was about energy. Or Diane Arbus, how about her?"
"Who's she?" Cynthia asked.
"A photographer who got famous taking pictures of women with beards and dwarves smoking cigarettes."
"Oh." Cynthia thought this over, and her face suddenly brightened with recollection.
"I saw this picture once at a catered party back when I was cocktailing. In an art gallery, this was. It was by some guy named Applethorpe, Robert Applethorpe. And you want to know what it was? One guy gobbling another guy's crank. Seriously. And it wasn't any fake job like in a Skin magazine either. I mean, that guy was making an effort. He was taking care of business and working overtime. You wouldn't think a guy could get that much of the old broom handle down his..."
"Mapplethorpe," Anna said dryly.
"Huh?"
"Mapplethorpe, not Applethorpe."
"Oh, yeah, I guess that's right.
He's dead now."
Oh, yeah? Cynthia asked. What got him?
AIDS. Anna was still looking at Rosie's picture and spoke absently. Known as broom handle disease in some quarters.
You said you saw a picture like Rosie's before, Gert rumbled. Where was that squirt? Same art gallery?
No. While discussing the Mapplethorpe, Cynthia had only looked interested. Now color pinked her cheeks and the corners of her mouth dimpled in a defensive little smile.
And it wasn't, you know, really the same, but...
Go on, tell, Rosie said.
Well, my dad was a Methodist minister back in Bakersfield, Cynthia said. This is Bakersfield, California, where I came from. We lived in the parsonage, and there were all these old pictures in the little meeting room downstairs. Some were presidents, and some were flowers, and some were dogs. They didn't matter. They were just things to hang on the wall so they wouldn't look too bare.
Rosie nodded, thinking of the pictures which had surrounded hers on those dusty pawn shop shelves. Gondolas in Venice, fruit in bowls, dogs and foxes. Just things to hang on the wall so they wouldn't look too bare. Mouths without tongues.
But there was this one, it was called... She frowned, trying to remember. I think it was called De Soto Looks West. It showed this explorer in tin pants and a saucepan hat standing on top of a cliff with these Indians around him. And he was looking over all these miles of woods towards a great big river, the Mississippi, I guess. But see, the thing was...
She looked at them uncertainly. Her cheeks were pinker than ever, and her smile was gone. The bulky bandage over her ear seemed very white, very much there, like some sort of peculiar accessory which had been grafted onto the side of her head. And Rosie found time to wonder, not for the first time since she'd come to DNS, why so many men were so unkind. What was wrong with them? Was it something that had been left out, or something nasty which had been unaccountably built in, like a bad circuit in a computer?
Go on, Cynthia, Anna said. We won't laugh, will we?
The women shook their heads. Cynthia stuck her hands behind her back like a little girl who was being called upon to recite in front of the entire class. Well, she said, speaking in a much smaller voice than her usual one.
It was like the river was moving. That was the thing that fascinated me. The picture was in the room where my father had his Thursday night Bible school classes, and I'd go in there, and sometimes I'd sit in front of that picture for an hour or more, looking at it like it was television. I was watching the river move, or waiting to see if it would move. Now I can't remember which, but I was only 9 or 10. One thing I do remember is thinking that if it was moving, a raft or a boat or an Indian canoe would go by sooner or later, and then I'd know for sure. Except one day I went in, and the picture was gone. Poof. I think my mother must have looked in and seen me just sitting there in front of it, you know, and she got worried and took it away, Robin said. Yeah, I probably threw it in the trash, Cynthia said. I was just a kid, but your picture reminds me of it, Rosie.
Pam peered at it closely.
Yep, she said. No wonder. I can see the woman breathing.
They all laughed then, and Rosie laughed with them.
No, it's not that, Cynthia said. It's just... It looks a little old-fashioned, you know? Like a schoolroom picture. And it's pale. Except for the clouds in her dress, the colors are pale. My De Soto picture, everything was pale except for the river. The river was bright silver. It looked more there than the rest of the picture.
Gert turned to Rosie.
Tell us about your job. I heard you say you got a job.
Tell us everything, Pam said.
Yes, Anna said. Tell us everything, and then I wonder if you could step into my office for a few minutes.
Is it what I've been waiting for?
Anna smiled. As a matter of fact, I think it is.
It's an optimum room, one of the best on our list, and I hope you'll be as delighted as I am, Anna said.
There was a stack of flyers perched precariously on the corner of her desk, announcing the forthcoming Daughters and Sisters Swing into Summer picnic and concert, an event which was part fundraiser, part community relations, and part celebration. Anna took one, turned it over, and sketched quickly. Kitchen here, hide-a-bed here, and a little living room area here. This is the bathroom. It's hardly big enough to turn around in, and in order to sit on the commode, you'll practically have to put your feet in the shower. But it's yours.
Yes, Rosie murmured. Mine.
A feeling that she hadn't had in weeks. That all this was a wonderful dream, and at any moment she would wake up beside Norman again, was creeping over her. The view is nice. It's not Lake Drive, of course, but Bryant Park is very pretty, especially in the summer. Second floor. The neighborhood got a little ragged in the 80s, but it's pulling itself together again now.
It's as if you stayed there yourself, Rosie said.
Anna shrugged, a slender, pretty gesture, and she drew the hall in front of the room, then a flight of stairs. She sketched with the no-frills economy of a draftsman. She spoke without looking up. I've been there on a good many occasions, she said, but of course that's not what you mean, is it?
No.
A little of me goes out with every woman when she leaves. I suppose that sounds corny, but I don't care. It's true. And that's all that really matters. So what do you think?
Rosie hugged her impulsively and instantly regretted it when she felt Anna stiffen. I shouldn't have done it, she thought as she let go. I knew better. And she had.
Anna Stevenson was kind. There was no doubt about that in Rosie's mind, maybe even saintly. But there was that strange arrogance. And there was this, too. Anna didn't like people in her space. Anna especially didn't like to be touched.
I'm sorry, she said, drawing back.
Don't be silly, Anna said brusquely. What do you think?
I love it, Rosie said.
Anna smiled, and the small awkwardness was behind them. She drew an X on the wall of the living room area near a tiny rectangle which represented the room's only window. Your new picture. I'll bet you decide it belongs right here.
I'll bet I do, too.
Anna put the pencil down. I'm delighted to be able to help you, Rosie, and I'm so glad you came to us. Here, you're leaking. It was the Kleenex again, but Rosie doubted it was the same box Anna had offered her during their first interview in this room. She had an idea that a lot of Kleenex got used in here. She took one and wiped her eyes.
You saved my life, you know, she said hoarsely. You saved my life, and I'll never, ever forget it.
Flattering, but inaccurate, Anna said in her dry, calm voice. I saved your life no more than Cynthia flipped Gert downstairs in the rec room. You saved your own life when you took a chance and walked out on the man who was hurting you.
Just the same, thank you. Just for being here.
You're very welcome, Anna said. And for the only time during her stay at DNS, Rosie saw tears standing in Anna Stevenson's eyes. She handed the box of Kleenex back across the desk with a little smile.
Here, she said. Looks like you've sprung a leak yourself.
Anna laughed, took a Kleenex, used it, and tossed it in the wastebasket. I hate to cry. It's my deepest, darkest secret. Every now and then I think I'm done with it, that I must be done with it, and then I do it again. It's sort of the way I feel about men.
For another brief moment, Rosie found herself thinking about Bill Steiner and his hazel eyes.
Anna took the pencil again and scratched something below the rough floor plan she'd drawn. Then she handed the sheet to Rosie. It was an address she'd jotted down, 897 Trenton Street. That's where you live, Anna said. It's most of the way across the city from here, but you can use the buses now, can't you? Smiling and still crying a little, Rosie nodded. You may give that address to some of the friends you've made here, and eventually to friends you make beyond here. But right now, nobody knows but the two of us. What she was saying felt like a set piece to Rosie, a goodbye speech. People who show up at your place will not have found out how to get there at this place. It's just how we do things at DNS. After 20 years of working with abused women, I'm convinced it's the only way to do things. Pam had explained all this to Rosie. So had Consuela Delgado and Robin St. James. These explanations had taken place during Big Fun Hour, which was what the residents called evening chores at DNS, but Rosie hadn't really needed them. It only took 3 or 4 therapy sessions in the front room for a person of reasonable intelligence to learn most of what she needed to know about the protocols of the house. There was Anna's list, and there were also Anna's rules. "How worried are you about him?" Anna asked. Rosie's attention had wandered a little. Now it snapped back in a hurry. At first, she wasn't even sure who Anna was talking about. "Your husband, how worried are you? I know that in your first 2 or 3 weeks here, you expressed fears that he would come after you, that he'd track you down, in your words. How do you feel about that now?" Rosie considered the question carefully. First of all, fear was an inadequate word to express her feelings about Norman during her first week or two at DNS. Even terror didn't completely serve, because the core of her feelings concerning him was lapped about, and to some degree altered, by other emotions. Shame at having failed in her marriage, homesickness for a few possessions she had cared deeply about, Pooh's chair, for instance, a sensation of euphoric freedom which seemed to renew itself at some point each day, and a relief so cold it was somehow horrible. The sort of relief a wire walker might feel after tottering at the furthest edge of balance while crossing a deep canyon, and then recovering. Fear had been the key chord, though, there was no doubt about that. During those first 2 weeks at DNS, she had had the same dream over and over. She was sitting in one of the wicker chairs on the porch when a brand new red Sentra pulled up to the curb in front. The driver's door opened, and Norman got out. He was wearing a black T-shirt with a map of South Vietnam on it. Sometimes the words beneath the map said, "Home is where the heart is." Sometimes they said, "Homeless and have AIDS." His pants were splattered with blood. Tiny bones, finger bones they looked like, dangled from his earlobes. In one hand he held some sort of mask which was splattered with blood and dark clots of meat. She tried to get up from the chair she was in and couldn't. It was as if she were paralyzed. She could only sit and watch him come slowly up the walk toward her with his bone earrings bobbing. Could only sit there as he told her he wanted to talk to her, up close. He smiled, and she saw his teeth were also covered with blood. "Rosie," Anna asked softly, "are you here?"
"Yes," she said, speaking in a little breathless rush. "I'm here, and yes, I'm still afraid of him."
"That's not exactly surprising, you know. On some level, I suppose you'll always be afraid of him. But you'll be all right as long as you remember that you're going to have longer and longer periods when you're not afraid of anything, and when you don't even think of him. But that isn't exactly what I asked, either. I asked if you're still afraid that he'll come after you."
"Yes," she was still afraid. No, not as afraid.
She had heard a lot of his business-related telephone conversations over the last 14 years, and she'd heard him and his colleagues discuss a lot of cases, sometimes in the rec room downstairs, sometimes out on the patio. They barely noticed her when she brought them warm-ups for their coffee or fresh bottles of beer. It was almost always Norman who led these discussions, his voice quick and impatient as he leaned over the table with a beer bottle half buried in one big fist, hurrying the others along, overriding their doubts, refusing to entertain their speculations. On rare occasions, he had even discussed cases with her. He wasn't interested in her ideas, of course, but she was a handy wall against which to bounce his own. He was quick, a man who wanted results yesterday, and he had a tendency to lose interest in cases once they were 3 weeks old. He called them what Gert had called her self-defense moves, leftovers. Was she a leftover to him now? How much she wanted to believe that, how hard she had tried, and yet she couldn't quite do it.
"I don't know," she said. "A part of me thinks that if he was going to show up, he would have already. But there's another part that thinks he's probably still looking.
And he's not a truck driver or a plumber. He's a cop. He knows how to look for people.
Anna nodded. Yes, I know. That makes him especially dangerous. And that means you'll have to be especially careful. It's also